John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Bukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, September 7, 2011. One killed in Gaza shelling and Israeli settlers vandalize an Israeli military base. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. One resident was killed and four others were injured on Tuesday evening when the army bombarded an area east of Al-Qarara in Khan Yunis in the southern part of Gaza Strip, the Palestine News and Information Agency Wafa reported. The slain resident was identified as Khalid Abu Samhoud, 22. His body and the four wounded residents were moved to Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. Furthermore, three military bulldozers and five tanks invaded the nearby Al-Qarara area and bulldozed farmlands while firing at random. The invasion came shortly after Israeli choppers opened fire into the area. The Arab League called on Wednesday for instating a comprehensive and serious popular and official boycott of Israel due to its ongoing violations and stances that obstruct peace talks. Mohammed Sbeh, Assistant Secretary General for Palestine and the Occupied Territories at the Arab League, stated, quote, "What is needed is a clear and direct aim that all Arab countries must abide by and implement," end quote. He added, quote, "Boycott is our main goal, and we are committed to what we agree on in order to reflect a real determination which could be carried out on the ground," end quote. In other news, Michel Besson, director of the Andine Cooperative, which develops fair trade cooperation with Palestine, was arrested Monday morning on his arrival at the airport in Tel Aviv and was placed in the retention center. Besson is denied entry to Palestine and is awaiting deportation, according to his lawyer Gabi Lasky. Lasky added that if Besson decides to fight deportation, he will have to wait a few weeks in jail before he can get a trial. On July 8, Israeli authorities deported over 150 internationals who arrived at the Tel Aviv airport and declared their intention to visit Palestine as part of the Welcome to Palestine campaign. The Isha Council of Settlements, the central body representing Israeli settlers in the West Bank, condemned the price tag operation carried out by a group of Israeli settlers at an Israeli military base on Wednesday. The council called on the government to crack down on what they called marginal group. Israeli sources reported earlier Wednesday that unknown perpetrators infiltrated a base in the Benjamin region, managed to sneak their way into the mechanics workshop on site where they slashed the tires and cut the cables of 13 military vehicles. Haaretz said on its online edition that this was the first price tag act extremist settlers have implemented against the army since adopting their policy of seeking retribution to exact for any curb on Israeli settlements in the West Bank. According to Haaretz, settlers sprayed the word price tag on the walls and painted graffiti related to the structures the military demolished in Migron illegal outpost near the West Bank city of Ramallah. Since the destruction of these structures, settlers have carried out a number of assaults against Palestinians, including torching a mosque near Nablus and assaulting Palestinian peddlers near Hebron. That was some of the news from Palestine today. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Hossam Kassis and me, George Ishmael.
Afghanistan, 6th of September. A construction contractor employed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was found beheaded in Kabul. Afghanistan, 3rd of September. NATO is reporting the death of two soldiers of unspecified nationality from insurgent attacks, one of them an IED blast, in undisclosed locations in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, 4th of September. A suicide car bomber killed two private security guards and wounded 21 others on Sunday in Afghanistan after attacking a convoy headed for NATO troops in the country. The explosion happened in the southern province of Kandahar, according to local officials, adding that the security guards were escorting a logistics convoy destined for NATO's International Security Assistance Force. Zalmay Ayoubi, a spokesman for the governor of Kandahar, named the security company as Afghanistan Naveen and said the attack happened close to the firm's premises. All of the dead and injured belonged to the security firm, with the exception of one of the wounded, a civilian. Afghanistan, ongoing. Mining corporations from Canada, India, and even Iran are seeking access to a massive iron ore deposit at Hajjuk, just 60 miles west of Kabul. The Canadian bidder is Toronto-based Kilo Gold Mines, which up until now has focused mainly on gold mining in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Needless to say, the years of war blamed for killing up to 6 million Congolese have been fueled by mining money. The Pentagon has gone so far as to explicitly state that they want to attract such foreign investment, claiming it will help stabilize the country. Gee, this sure hasn't done much to stabilize the Congo. Baghdad, Iraq, 7th of September. A magnetic bomb attached to a civilian car blew up and wounded two people in the Mansour district of west central Baghdad, according to police. There are still bombs going off almost every single day in Baghdad. Diwania, Iraq, 7th of September. Armed fighters raided the homes of a local governor, two tribal chiefs, and a policeman. One of the tribal chiefs was killed, and all their other targets were wounded. Kirkuk, Iraq, 6th of September. A roadside bomb went off while the bomb squad was trying to defuse it. You heard that? Roadside bombs are still going off in Iraq over 8 years after George W. Bush claimed the combat operations in Iraq were over. Nasiriyah, Iraq, 5th of September. Two Iraqi civilians were detained by U.S. air mobile troops in northern Nasiriyah, the center of southern Iraq's Saikar province, on Sunday, a Saikar official reported. Nasiriyah City has witnessed broad U.S. air activity by warplanes and helicopters that flew at low altitudes over the city. Wait a minute. What U.S. air mobile operations? I thought U.S. combat operations in Iraq were over. Oh, yeah. That's been said before. Mr. Barack Obama, haven't we had enough of this? Now's the time to pull the plug on war. Bring all the troops home today. from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com.
A new report finds that growing hatred toward Muslims in the U.S. is not spontaneous. Following a six-month-long investigation, the Center for American Progress recently released a report titled Fear Incorporated, The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America, which traces $42 million in funding that has flowed from conservative foundations over the past 10 years to groups that have helped fan the flames of anti-Muslim hate in America. The report examines how funders, scholars, grassroots activists, media personalities, and political actors have effectively disseminated false narratives, including President Obama is a secret Muslim, that most mosques in America are incubators of radicalization, and that Muslims are attempting to covertly impose the Quran's Sharia law on the people of the United States. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Faz Shakir, vice president of ThinkProgress.org, a co-author of the Fear Incorporated report, who summarizes his investigation and the motivation and goals of those working to demonize Islam.
If you look at the Washington Post ABC News survey of American attitudes towards Muslims and Islam, it is actually far worse now than it was shortly after 9/11, that people view Muslims more negatively now than they have ever before. And I think that there's a reason for that. Shortly after 9/11, President Bush, as a leader of the nation, but also his Republican Party, told his base that we aren't at war with Islam. And I think that was very helpful to tamping down his own kind of right flank that may have had an interest in trying to generate some kind of clash of civilizations theory. And for 8 years, I think he did a fine job of trying to hold that right flank down. And then, of course, once he left office, the Republican Party had a vacuum of leadership, and what you ended up seeing was a competition amongst right-wing fringe groups for attention. And one of those groups, as we document in our report, is the Islamophobia Network. It's really just a small group of individuals, five individuals who we list: David Yerushalmi, Robert Spencer, Frank Gaffney, Daniel Pipe, Stephen Emerson, who've been at this for a decade and have been producing reports suggesting that there's a, quote, creeping Sharia threat in America, that Muslims want to replace the U.S. Constitution with some Islamic law, that mosques are incubators for terrorism, that President Obama himself may be a secret Muslim. These are the kinds of theories that have been put out by a small number of people and have reached large audiences because there are a whole host of politicians and media players who are giving them a platform to spout their hate rhetoric. And what we try to do in this report is document who these small number of actors are and try to urge people to marginalize and distance themselves from this kind of hate rhetoric.
In your report, Fear Incorporated, you talk about the rise of hatred towards the Islamic religion in this country as not exactly being accidental. You document the enormous amounts of money that are being poured into the Islamophobia network, as you call it.
Yeah, we document a little over $42 million over the past 10 years has gone to this small network of actors. It has come from largely seven conservative foundations. That money has helped seed a lot of these organizations that are devoted to producing anti-Muslim propaganda. For instance, Frank Gaffney's organization is called the Center for Security Policy, and what they have done with their money is produce reports claiming that Sharia is going to take over the United States of America. David Yerushalmi, one of Frank Gaffney's counsels, has authored legislation in various states to ban the use of Sharia by courts, and that kind of scaremongering, fear-mongering, when, you know, this is basically a baseless threat. There's no potential concern that Sharia is going to take over any judicial system in America, and yet there are people who are profiting off making that an argument. And to see their influence, quite frankly, is to watch how the Park 51 controversy blew up. It originally started with Daisy Khan, who was one of the co-leaders of the project, going on Fox News with Laura Ingraham, and Laura Ingraham telling her that, you know what, I support your project. I appreciate what you're doing. You're trying to instill a moderate brand of Islam in America and trying to incorporate them into American civic life. It sounded like a good project, but within the next year and a half, you had Pamela Geller, Robert Spencer authoring blog posts and appearing on radio and attending rallies at New York City, calling this a victory mosque at ground zero. And it engendered a whole bunch of controversy. It came from just a small number of people, but ultimately ended up grabbing the whole nation's attention and even forced President Obama to weigh in.
Faiz, your report, Fear Incorporated, The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. What's been the response to the report so far, and what would you like ultimately to see be born out of the information that you investigated here?
Yeah, it's interesting what has happened since we released the report. The individuals that we cited, Robert Spencer, David Horowitz, Frank Gaffney, have all issued statements, and they have, in doing so, have revealed their true colors. So in almost every single one of those statements that they have issued in response to our report, none of them have challenged a fact about our report. The facts still stand as strong as the day we released them. But what they have done is suggest that we're, quote, part of the stealth jihadist campaign, that we are part of the Islamic insurgency or some kind of anti-Muslim innuendo has worked its way into those responses. And it just goes to show what they're all about. It's generally hate rhetoric, trying to smear you with some kind of tie to Muslim terrorism, and that's their modus operandi. What we're hoping to do is isolate them from everybody else, and hopefully have everybody else understand that these people are extremists.
That was Faiz Shakir, Vice President of ThinkProgress.org and co-author of the report, Fear Incorporated, The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. Find links to more information about the report and Islamophobia on our website at btlonline.org. In September 2001, Anne McGrath Muldery, mother of eight children and a retired educator and semi-retired writer, had been an active member of the national Catholic group Pax Christi, living in a small town south of Albany, New York. On 9/11, her son Stephen was killed where he worked in the South Tower of the World Trade Center. He died with his colleagues in a conference room on the 89th floor, where before the building collapsed, they shared a single cell phone to place calls and leave messages of love to those they knew they would be leaving behind. Shortly before President Bush launched his March 2003 invasion of Iraq, Muldery joined the group September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, where she now serves on the organization's steering committee. Peaceful Tomorrows, founded by family members of those killed on September 11th, advocates for nonviolent options and actions in the pursuit of justice in an effort to break the cycles of violence engendered by war and terrorism. Among the group's goals are promotion of a U.S. foreign policy that places a priority on internationally recognized principles of human rights, democracy, and self-rule. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Anne Muldery, who reflects on the wars and violence that have followed the 9/11 attacks 10 years ago and explains how she transformed her grief into a prayer for peace and love.
Somebody said to me shortly after the terrible tragedy that they thought the people who had done this were certainly going to be in hell. Now, I was not made happy by that because I don't know hell. I don't know about hell. And I loved this person, though, who was talking to me. And that person cared so much about me that I said, you know, I don't know where they went, but they all went together. And the hijackers were as much my sons as Stephen. Their minds had been warped by leaders who told them that this was the right thing to do, and not only that, that God would be happy if they did it. Now that's who I look to blame. Leaders who warp other people's minds and tell them to do something that is not good for the world.
And tell us why you joined with the group September 11th, Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. And what does the work that you do with that group mean to you?
Well, I'm 75 years old. I was 65 when Stephen died. And immediately after that terrible loss, that terrible shock in the family, my concerns were pretty much supporting one another to get through this. But I was not in favor of the bombing of Afghanistan. I never have favored bombing as a weapon of war. I feel, you know, that it cannot help but destroy innocent people. But I was alone in my thinking in many instances, and not looking for opportunities to proclaim my own beliefs. And then I came upon a news release that was sent by this group who I had never heard of, and it was September 11th, Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, and it was critical of the administration's preparations for the invasion of Iraq. And as I read that news release, I thought I could have written this news release. There isn't a word in it that I couldn't sign my name to. So I called these people up and reached them. They were a small group of maybe 40 people and growing. And I went down, and they were having a regular gathering, and I just joined them, and I thought, these people are worth leaving Kinderhook for, you know, to come and to do what I can do. And that's what I've done ever since. And what I do is I speak around the country and even out of the country, and I write. And that's about what I do. I try to keep up with all of the issues that Peaceful Tomorrows, as an organization, is faced with. We are not foreign policy experts, of course. We're just human beings who were brought together because somebody we love died in the same terrible moment. But at the same time, we have come together to say that we want to be the voice of those family members who, like us, feel that retaliation, violence, is not going to do what people think it might. That's the tricky thing that you have to keep in mind. And one of the reasons I liked this group so much is that they chose for their name a quote of Martin Luther King Jr., which was that wars are poor chisels for carving out peaceful tomorrows. Reverend King was respecting the fact that some people believe that wars are the chisels to carve out peaceful tomorrows. Some people think it's the only chisel, and some people think it's the best chisel. Well, he reminds us they're very poor chisels, if that's your goal, a peaceful tomorrow, because violence begets violence, and I put it in my own mind that you're sowing dragon's teeth. They will come back to repay what you have done when you turn violent in your effort to rid what you perceive is evil from the world. That was what those hijackers were doing. They were using the deaths of innocent people to try and right what they perceived to be a wrong, and they perceived their victims to be their enemies. Well, that's history over and over and over and over again. There are plenty of instances in history where we can find examples that other means were reached toward the goal of justice and peace, if indeed that's truly what someone wants, and that when you do use violence, what you do is become the evil you're trying to destroy. At least that's my personal feeling about it, that if I use violence, I'm becoming what I'm trying to rid the world of.
That was Anne McGrath Mulderry, who serves on the steering committee of the group September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Find out more about the group's projects by visiting our website at btlonline.org. In the decades since the 9/11 attacks, the FBI has unleashed thousands of paid informants to detect potential terrorist threats. At times, these informants have acted as agent provocateurs in crafting new terror plots. FBI informer Shadid Hussain posed as a recruiter for the Pakistani terror group Jaish-e-Mohammed in Newburgh, New York,
a depressed Hudson River Valley town, and persuaded disgruntled Walmart worker Jamie Cromartie to participate in a plot to bomb Bronx synagogues. The FBI has also conducted extensive data mining operations to pinpoint specific ethnic and Muslim communities for future undercover activities. According to Mother Jones magazine, the FBI is working with a strategy of preemption, prevention, and disruption of potential terrorists who might lead a lone wolf attack like the failed bombing of Times Square. Mother Jones and the University of California, Berkeley Investigative Reporting Program reviewed 500 anti-terror cases over the last decade. They found half the cases involved paid informants, and nearly all of the high-profile terror cases were the result of FBI sting operations with informants involved in the plot.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. The opposition to the Keystone XL tar sands oil pipeline did not begin with 2 weeks of civil disobedience in front of the White House. That civil disobedience ran from the 20th of August through the 3rd of September and led to 1,252 arrests, the largest civil disobedience in recent history in D.C. Instead, opposition to the Keystone XL tar sands oil pipeline began in Native American communities being harmed by the existing tar sands mining projects.
I've been fighting really, really, really hard against this for at least the past 2 years, because 2 years ago was when something horrible, horrible, horrible happened at home. You know, they told us, oh, we need the oil. So our leaders, quote unquote, are like, okay, how much money are you going to give us? Okay, because it comes down to money, right? In a lot of these circumstances. And so, then guess what happened? Right away, accident. Oil tanker driving that water, cruising all over our roads like he owns them, ran my friend off the road, killed her.
People are dying. Literally, right now, I have people in the hospital undergoing treatments for chemotherapy.
The campaign against the Keystone XL pipeline did not end with 1,252 arrests in front of the White House. Already, organizers of the two-week campaign are readying another day of action on the 2nd of October. President Obama does what he did on ground-level ozone and stabs his environmentalist base in the back. The campaign against the pipeline won't end there either. Instead, it will have just begun. Right now, tar sands mining is being limited by available pipeline capacity. The best way for people who do not live where the tar sands are mined to help indigenous people stop the expansion of the mines is to block the pipeline. The best way for people living in coastal cities vulnerable to a future of Katrina-class hurricanes is to block the pipeline. In other words, this is not a consumer issue, but a strategic issue. When people don't like animals being tortured by contract laboratories like Huntington Life Sciences, they don't waste time protesting at a lab that will never listen.
We told you we would keep coming back.
Instead, they force bankers, insurers, and customers to boycott the offender. If making it impossible for a vivisection laboratory to get a bank account can lead to an Animal Liberation Front visit finding two-thirds of the cages empty, then surely making it impossible for a dirty tar sands mining project to get oil pipelines can choke off their expansion, save Native American homes and access to clean water, and help put the brakes on climate catastrophe. Here is Amy Goodman's recent Democracy Now! Interview with Bill McKibbins concerning the pipeline protests in front of the White House, the Keystone XL pipeline, the recent hurricane, and global climate change. As of today, Bill McKibbins has even been published in Newsweek. The protests against the Keystone XL pipeline are beginning to bite, and people are starting to pay attention. Without further ado, here's Amy Goodman interviewing Bill McKibbin.
Hey, Amy, it was very good to hear Governor Shumlin, and of course, it's unbelievably hard not to be home. My town is taking a beating. The town next door, East Middlebury, was apparently evacuated last night. All the roads connecting up to my town are cut off. It's killing me not to be there, and I'd be there in a flash, except that I think the work we're doing here in Washington right now is key towards trying to rein this kind of thing in the future.
We did not hear those words, global warming. I watched a lot of the media coverage this weekend. What about this? I mean, to say the least, there was time and the endless coverage.
Well, here's what's, I mean, first of all, here's what's going on. I mean, I wrote the first book about climate change 22 years ago this year. And I should begin by saying there's very little satisfaction in saying I told you so. We knew then enough to predict exactly what was going to happen. And climatologists 22 years ago were saying this is what to look forward to. The basic physical property here is that warm air holds more water vapor than cold. You can get stronger storms. The atmosphere is about 4% wetter than it was 40 years ago. That's an enormous change in a basic physical parameter. It loads the dice for both drought as you're getting increased evaporation and deluge and downpour and flood, and that's what we're seeing all over the planet. You remember the pictures from Pakistan this time last summer with a quarter of the country underwater. You remember the pictures from Queensland in Australia. You remember the pictures earlier this year in the Missouri and Mississippi River basins, which saw more water go down them than ever before. As Governor Shumlin said, the Northeast was hard hit earlier this year. We had absolutely record flood levels at Lake Champlain, where there are records dating back more than 250 years. Now we're seeing, as this water drops across the Northeast, rivers and streams at levels that we have literally never seen them before. That's what it means when a 250-year-old covered bridge goes washing down the Queechee River. It's on the one hand, entirely predictable, and on the other hand, the greatest sort of series of wake-up calls that we could possibly be getting. So far this year, it's only August, so far this year, the U.S. has suffered more billion-dollar weather-related disasters than any year in history. Last year was the warmest year in the planet's history. Arctic ice is at record low levels, on and on and on, which is why, you know, I mean, we're going to have to do two things. One, as Governor Shumlin says, is figure out how we protect places against trouble that we can no longer completely prevent. We've already raised the temperature of the planet a degree. That's not going away. The scientists tell us there's another degree in the pipeline that's coming at us from a carbon we've already emitted. So that's job one. Job two, equally important, is stop pouring more into the atmosphere. And that's why I think that message is getting through. I was worried that Hurricane Irene would slow down these protests that have been building in Washington, that last week were the biggest civil disobedience protests in at least in a generation in the environmental movement. I need not have worried. I was at the church last night where people were preparing for this morning's arrests, by far the biggest crowd yet, over 100 people who will be arrested, along with Jim Hansen, the NASA scientist, who said if we start burning these unconventional fuel sources in a big way, then it's essentially game over for the climate. Game over. I mean, right now, game on.
Explain. In the last few weeks, we've experienced earthquakes, which many scientists say are not related to climate change, and I'd like to get your view on that. And then we move right to this unprecedented hurricanes. And again, for people to understand how hurricanes work and why, for example, Vermont is seeing floods reminiscent of 1927, a number of bridges.
Floods worse than 1927, yeah.
And so much was wiped out at that time that a lot of time you can trace 80 years to what we saw in Vermont in 1938 and 1927, the Great Hurricane, these two great disasters.
We're in unprecedented, off the charts territory. It's not that there haven't been disasters before. There have always been disasters. Nature is relatively random in that sense. But now we're seeing two things. One, disasters that go beyond the bounds of what we've ever seen before. Because there's more water in the atmosphere, it's possible to have bigger floods, record snowfalls when it's cold, record rainstorms. And we're seeing more of them in conjunction. I mean, think about what's been going on just on this continent this year. We're about 1.5% of the surface area of the globe in the continental U.S. And we've had not only this extraordinary flooding, but on the same day that Hurricane Irene was coming down, Houston set its all-time temperature record, 109 degrees. We're in the middle of the worst drought ever recorded in Texas. And, Governor Perry's prayers for rain have so far been unanswered, maybe because he's done so little to ameliorate the flow of carbon into the atmosphere. We're in a new situation. It doesn't mean that everything that happens is caused by global warming. Hurricanes aren't caused by global warming. They're caused by tropical waves drifting off the coast of Africa and encountering the Earth's spin, that can begin to set them into rotation. But they are made more powerful. As this hurricane rode up the coast, one of the reasons it was able to pick up so much water that it's now dumping on Vermont and Quebec is that sea surface temperatures were at an all-time record high off New York and New Jersey. Never, the last 2 years have seen the highest temperatures ever recorded in those waters. When you amp up a system, and so far we've added about 0.75 watt per square meter of the Earth's surface extra solar energy to the planet by burning coal and gas and oil. When you do that, you can expect more dynamic, more amped up, more violent weather. And that's exactly what we're seeing. Earthquakes, with rare exceptions, are not climate related. There is reason to think that in certain localized places, earthquakes are now resulting from some of this kind of fracking attempts to get oil and gas out of the ground through unconventional means. And in Greenland, there's increased seismicity as that huge sheet of ice begins to melt and unweight the land beneath it. But for the most part, volcanic and tectonic forces are still beyond the reach of human beings. Everything else bears our thumbprint now. And the only way to deal with that is to quickly get off coal and gas and oil. We're not at the moment in our Congress, prepared to do that. That's why it's good news that at the very least, President Obama can keep us from getting in any deeper without even asking Congress. He can veto this Keystone Pipeline thing and prevent us from taking the next step into the brave new world of unconventional energy.
Bill McKibben, finally, the State Department ruling, why so many are being arrested in Washington, D.C., the XL pipeline.
Yeah. This pipeline goes to the second largest pool of carbon on the planet, the tar sands of Alberta. The State Department, which was responsible for doing an environmental impact statement, released its statement last Friday. It was completely expected. It has hundreds of pages of detailed accounting of exactly how many leaks per kilometer of pipeline are acceptable and on and on and on. What it doesn't talk about at all, does not even mention, are the carbon implications of opening up a Saudi-sized pool of oil. That oil has to stay in the ground. It's as important that it stay in the ground as it is that Brazil guard its rainforest. That's why hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people have been arrested here. This protest at tarsandsaction.org has taken off in ways that we couldn't have expected when we started a week ago. It's turned into something very, very large. All the environmental groups said last week that this was now the premier challenge on the environment for President Obama between now and the election. And they said, we expect nothing less than his veto, which he can do without even asking Congress. There's never been a purer test of whether or not we're prepared to stand up to climate change or not. I'm going back down to the White House this morning. There'll be more than 100 people arrested, on and on and on for the next few days, right through September 3rd. We hope that people will join us at tarsandsaction.org. this is sort of unexpectedly spiked into the biggest thing of its kind in a very long time. And that should be very good news. Part of the way that we react to traumas like Irene is to figure out how to prevent them from happening. I'm eating away at me not to be in Vermont, and I you know, can't tell you how worried I am for my friends and family up there. But the way that I'm going to show it today is being back in front of the White House and doing what we can to head this kind of thing off.
We want to thank you very much for being with us. Bill McKibben in Washington, D.C. right now, part of the mass protests around the XL Keystone pipeline.
You may have heard of Huntington Life Sciences, a contract animal testing laboratory that kills 500 animals every day, one with incredibly shoddy practices, where scientists have been caught penciling in test results, and where so-called researchers have been caught doing things like punching beagle puppies in the face, which has absolutely nothing to do even with their kind of science. One of their customers turns out to be the American Petroleum Institute, or API. On the 3rd of September, as the protests in front of the White House against the filthy Keystone XL tar sands oil pipeline were wrapping up, animal rights protesters showed up in front of the home of Luciano B. Hayden, who is in charge of government relations for the American Petroleum Institute, or API. Take long for neighbors to start getting upset.
Yeah. I mean, so we're here, like, we're not going to back down. And we've given them this notice. We've given them notification. Like, yeah, because we gave them notification within 2 hours. We're completely fine with all of us. We're on a public sidewalk here, sir. So, you know, we're just walking for a lot. So, yeah, okay.
I don't know what's going on at the American Petroleum Institute, but then again, it doesn't surprise me. It's the kind of people who will throw Native American people off their lands for the Alberta tar sands mining project would also not be above pumping pregnant rats full of gasoline. And American Petroleum Institute, until you dump Huntington Life Sciences, until you stop testing gasoline on pregnant rats, you're going to have problems with protests at both the offices and the homes of your executives. Because in D.C. there's no sleep for the wicked. Rolling in on Brian Maloney. On the 3rd of September, animal rights activists return to the ritzy La Trobe in downtown Washington, home of AstraZeneca executive Brian Maloney. AstraZeneca is a top customer of Huntington Life Sciences, a contract animal research lab where undercover investigators have caught so-called researchers doing things like punching beagle puppies in the face, where 500 animals are killed every day testing things like bleach and Splenda. The La Trobe. Last time they were here was 7:30 a.m. as a hurricane bore down in the city.
Quit my job this morning. is. In case you forgot, how do you like that? It is a contract animal family facility. And we're responding with the animals each and every day of the week. You've been exposed. We have an eye and an undercover investigation. I see 20-month-old beagle puppies in my face.
Why not get some rest?
It's your time. Let's go up.
Brian Maloney.
Take long for the building manager to come out claiming that Brian Maloney doesn't live there anymore. There's just one problem. Brian Maloney's phone number is still on the call box of the building entry system, and it still connects to his telephone, and his answering machine is connected to it.
It's linked to his phone number. I heard his voice. I know what he looks like. We know what he looks like.
How can someone who does not have a unit in this building have their phone linked to your call box? That's using up your bandwidth, it's costing you money, it's using up your assets.
It's not costing them money, it's not going to be that
bring to the apartment. Like, it means the apartment is not occupied because that mailbox is not occupied.
That costs money,
no,
too.
The call box goes to their phone. They can always access it.
I mean, we...
Man, cut the shit. That call box is part of the building entry system. And if Brian Maloney didn't live there, and you still connected that apartment number to his phone, it would mean anybody else living in that apartment couldn't be buzzed from the door. At this point, the building manager said he'd go inside, get the name of the person now living in the apartment, and come back out. He never reappeared, so between the unlikeliness of the call box still being given to Brian Maloney a year after they claim he moved out, plus the failure to reappear of the building manager, protesters concluded that Brian Maloney still lives in the latrobe, and we commenced their protest.
All right, the manager of the latrobe came out here and told us that Brian Maloney does not live here, although his name is on the call box, and it does link to his phone, and it does link to everything else. So, since it's been over 10 minutes, and the manager of the latrobe has not come out and given us verification and given us proof that Brian Maloney doesn't live here, we're going to continue to be out here naming and shaming Brian Maloney because he's an AstraZeneca, the top customer of Money to Power Science.
There's
no excuse for animal abuse! There's no excuse for animal abuse! Brian Maloney, there's no excuse for animal abuse!
Huntington Life Sciences once was a billion-dollar industry, and now, after a 10-year campaign, Huntington Life Sciences is over $100 million in debt. They can't get a bank account. They can't get an insurance provider. Brian Maloney, customer after customer, investment company after investment company, keeps on dropping Huntington Life Sciences until... So, Brian Maloney, right now, the global animal liberation movement is targeting AstraZeneca. So we are going to be out here time and time again. We're going to be at your front doorsteps of your office, front doorsteps of your executives' homes, wherever you guys are at. We're going to be there to name and shame you, to make sure that you know your complicity in Huntington Life Sciences and what you need to do to end this badness, to end these protests. We're never going to back down here in D.C. We're never going to give in, and we're never going to compromise Brian Maloney until AstraZeneca cuts all ties with Huntington Life Sciences. Once AstraZeneca has issued an official letter to the campaign, it sort of states that you have cut all ties with Huntington Life Sciences, all of this will go away.
Until next time, until all are free, we'll be back.
Jared Ball, DJ Munch, Chocolate City, this is a movement, music.
Have you
heard the news?
Walmart's coming.
Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Thumping.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave laborers. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market. Hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than the male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart,
it's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holla black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister, Strom Thurmond, similar, Confederate, state loving George Bush ministers. Oversee a plantation mentality, results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they wanna come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts, Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me.
They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
DC Walmart Free is an emerging activist group of DC residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in DC by 2012. Walmarts in DC will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
When Steve Jobs stepped down as Apple's CEO for health reasons, he was lauded as a genius who revolutionized consumer technology with the iPod, the iPhone, and the iPad. But under Jobs' long tenure, the company also fueled the export of computer jobs to China and other low-wage countries. In 2010, Apple was linked to the tragedy of worker suicides at the Foxconn factory complex in China, which manufactures the iPhone and iPad. According to the news magazine In These Times, the dark underbelly of the tech industry has been largely forgotten due to Apple's soaring stock prices and Jobs' long record of creating the next must-have tech gadget. Since the 1970s, the U.S.-based computer industry has exploded to a $200 billion a year enterprise. But today, there are only 150,000 Americans working in the industry because production has moved to cheaper, low-wage labor markets. As Jobs unveiled a new version of the iPhone in 2010, the British newspaper The Daily Mail reported on the horrific working conditions at the huge Foxconn complex near Shenzhen, China. The plant's managers had just installed new security measures like wire mesh fencing to keep workers from jumping off tall buildings. Apple's own review of its suppliers showed extensive abuse of workers' rights. Over a third of its contract suppliers ignored Apple's rules and required employees to work over 60 hours a week. In addition, over 95 factories failed to conduct regular safety inspections, yet Apple only canceled 2 of its suppliers' contracts.